Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Noah Seckham, coming to you from the Parliament House newsroom in Canberra on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country. Today on the show...
These are uncertain times, but I'm absolutely certain of this. We will deal with these global challenges the Australian way, working together and looking after each other, as we always have.
Communities from across the country brace for further impact as fuel prices increase and the Prime Minister calls for cooperation. And later today...
Australian industrial relations system really has issue about systematic undervaluation of predominantly female workforces.
Pathologists and dental assistants have received a much-needed pay rise, according to a leading health union. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. But first up, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's address to the nation last night has been met with mixed reactions. The Coalition have been particularly critical, with Liberal leader Angus Taylor telling ABC Radio the address could have been a social media post.
It didn't lay out what the situation was clearly. It didn't lay out what the plan was clearly, and it certainly didn't give the confidence Australians need right now to get about their lives. And right now, that's what we want.
Liam Fitzgerald, the owner and director of the independent Southwest Local News in regional Victoria, says he welcomed the Prime Minister voicing support for the nation. But Mr. Fitzgerald says the future is uncertain for his local community.
When we saw the announcement come up on social media that the PM was going to make an address to the nation for the first time since COVID, a lot of people was like, wow, this could be quite big, this could be quite brutal. You know, it certainly captured the attention of everyone, but once the announcement sort of started happening there, it wasn't really a case of something we didn't know already, was it really? We knew things were getting tough. We knew that the prices were going up. All we really needed to know is that the government had our back and what they're doing to try and help. If people don't have money to go out for dinner or go to the retail sector because they're spending all their money on petrol, it's going to be similar to the pandemic in some instances when there's going to be, you know, businesses that might not make it through.
Well, what's the reaction in Warrnambool at the moment with the current fuel crisis?
We've had a couple of service stations over the journey, particularly the last fortnight or so. There's been one or two that have actually ran out of supply, but... prices are what everyone's talking about. We're seeing prices upwards of $3.40, $3.50, some really huge prices there. And I know that we've had an excise that's come in, and there's obviously talk that that's going to be helpful while it lasts, but it's a high likelihood that it's not going to last too long. And then even after the excise finishes, it could still go up. So, you know, it's been a pretty tough couple of years down here with drought and a few other things. So I think really high fuel prices, particularly diesel, is certainly going to really have a pretty big effect, not just on those that directly need it, but the flow-on effects as well.
To the character, I guess, of your community, is it a large trucking area? Is it a large farming area?
So Southwest Victoria is probably one of Victoria's most prominent food food and fibre producers. Dairy industry is massive, and you know, dairies need tractors. It's a huge farming community, but there's also a lot of transport companies down here as well. We've got quite a large bus company, Warrnambool Bus Lines, and they have buses right around, not just Warrnambool, but Portland, Mount Gambier, a lot of those other places. And then of course we've got the Midfield Group, which is a massive meat manufacturer, not just here in Australia, but export as well. They've got B triples that go up the highway to Melbourne a fair bit. And of course, we've got a very high transport of meat to be processed at the plant. So, it's going to be interesting to see what the fallout is.
You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs from all over Australia.
Interest in electric vehicles has rapidly increased as petrol prices rise across the country. The latest Google Trends data shows a sudden spike in Australians looking into EVs, with reports car dealerships are receiving hundreds of inquiries every day. But a new car isn't feasible for many households. CEO of Rewiring Australia, Francis Fearboom, says the federal government needs to step up and increase incentives for electric vehicle ownership in the May budget.
Yeah, so we've been talking with the government about this, you know, over the last few weeks as well. And I was in Canberra on Monday talking about the importance of the EV discount in this moment and the fact that it does give a wider range of families the option of actually jumping on the opportunity to get an EV. And that obviously that's just a really good opportunity for people right now who are looking to get out of the way of petrol prices. And if you've got the kind of middle class job that offers salary packaging and can get you access to that deal, then that's a really good option for everyday families to actually make this shift because it is a big upfront cost. And I think that the government's looking at a really different economy than it was even looking at maybe a month ago as well, because an oil price shock really works its way through all the prices we pay. It's going to affect groceries. It's going to affect deliveries. It's going to affect a lot of things that we pay for. So it's obviously becoming a national strategy that we need to follow to actually break that cycle and find a way for our businesses to start running not on oil and a globally exposed volatile price, but on an energy source that we can actually rely on. To go into like a little bit of economics on this, I think that in particular, the government has an interesting challenge because it's really hard to manage a crisis like this because, you know, spending money or giving people tax breaks will tend to make inflation worse and add pressure into the economy. And so it's kind of understood to be like a really tricky problem to deal with stagflation. The interesting thing about offering people salary packaging for EVs is that, for one, it actually reduces people's take-home pay because you're paying off that vehicle lease. So for a short time, you're actually getting less money, which is kind of what the economy needs right now, is for people to actually be taking home a bit less cash. So that's one thing. The other thing is that because that money actually does go, like all the cars we buy are imported, so that money goes offshore, it's actually not money that's going into the Australian economy and heating things up. So there's a really unusual policy analysis that would suggest that actually helping more people get EV leases or salary package financing options is actually maybe exactly what the economy needs right now, in both a macro sense and in, you know, a getting off oil sense.
Moving to electricity beyond just transport in all parts of life, is it more important for the government to have the clean production of electricity top of mind? Is this really a push to move towards renewables?
Well, in a way, but to be honest, that's the part of it that I think is just already irreversibly underway. And in some ways, you know, there is some really important work to do to make sure that we finish the job of deploying large-scale renewables in Australia, but we're already past 50%. And we're on track to be somewhere close to 80% in 2030, if not the 82% target the government's shooting towards. They're going to get close, whether or not they exactly hit the mark. So I'm not sure that's even the important debate right now, to be totally honest, that, you know, solar panels outcompete all other forms of generation. If we're building solar and wind and batteries, we get an electricity system that's really reliable and that works onshore from Australian resources that we have lots of. So it's just the obvious choice that's already getting invested in. The really hard thing is actually shifting the demand side machines and getting those to run on electricity, because the supply chains that that supply the equipment that runs on fossil fuels are changing much, much slower than that electricity generation mix is changing. And that's where we have a real opportunity to strengthen the Australian economy, is in actually moving our machines to run on that electricity that it's so easy for us to make. It's also worth pointing out that in this particular fossil fuel price crisis, what we've seen from batteries is really amazing, because what it means that we have so many big batteries in the system is that even though the price of gas has run up a lot in the international market, we're not seeing any of that price increase come through in the electricity system. Last time in 2022, when the Ukraine war spiked gas prices, that jacked up electricity prices because we were doing a lot of electricity generation by burning gas in gas peaking plants. And batteries have started really eating the lunch of all of those gas peakers and forcing them to actually bid in at lower prices. So it's a really strong story for the renewable evolution of the grid that in this crisis, we're going to see electricity prices move a lot less in response than we did last time.
The ACT government is the latest jurisdiction to announce efforts to ease the cost of travel and to incentivise public transport. Victoria and Tasmania announced a fare-free period of 1 and 3 months respectively earlier this week. Now in Canberra, the current monthly fare cap of 40 paid trips for full adult fares and 30 trips for students will be halved. The Public Transport Association of Canberra has welcomed the policy.
To me, this type of fare relief initiative strikes a good balance between doing nothing and providing free public transport. So doing nothing is potentially not feasible for the ACT government in the current political climate, and I understand that. However, 3 months of fully free public transport is an expense that the ACT budget just cannot accommodate at this point in time.
Community Radio 2XX spoke with the chair of the authority, Amy Jelicic, earlier this week about the concerns with the network's capacity for increased ridership. We've heard a lot of talk from across the country, a lot of push from folks like the Greens saying that public transport should be made free during this broad fuel crisis. What is your take on that?
Our association has a variety of views among its members, and I think that's just important to acknowledge because the topic of free or really cheap public transport has a lot of different facets to it. In looking at the current debate, I'm really focused in on getting the right parameters for the debate. And what we're looking at here is a fuel crisis, so high fuel prices, and the type of behaviour that that may potentially encourage in people who would be normally driving. So the question is, how do we make public transport an attractive option to people who habitually drive? Evidence from different cities, and I think even our own, shows us that people who habitually drive are not typically very price sensitive. So they're unlikely to be swayed by something like cheaper or even free public transport fares. And that's, I guess, my starting point for looking at this specific context. So there might be other reasons why we would look at changing public transport fare cost, things like social inclusion or social justice. And I think that parties like the Greens can speak really well to those sorts of issues. For me right now, though, I'm really focused on the types of things that encourage something that we call mode shift in the public transport world, which looks at what percentage of the population uses different types of transport.
Do you think that the current system in Canberra could actually handle everyone taking the bus tomorrow instead of driving? And what would it take for people to make that shift?
I guess there's two parts to the question. Firstly, could we handle even more people hopping on board? In some parts of the network, yes. In other parts, no. In some parts of the network, it would really be very, very difficult to cope with more people hopping on board. This, of course, is all happening at the same time that we're seeing significant changes to Canberra's road networks caused by the Commonwealth Bridge closure and the different lane configuration there. So that's impacted on public transport operations and has meant that we're seeing essentially more people hopping on fewer services. So that's how Transport Canberra is currently operating. So for particular routes, and I'm thinking particularly about the R4, which sees really high patronage, the R2 also, I think really many of our rapid routes would struggle a great deal with more people hopping on board. We know that light rail gets super, super busy, like packed with people, particularly in those peak hours. And again, that would be really difficult to cope with even more. I just don't think that they could physically pack more people on board. The topic of changing comes up a lot in box pops and Facebook comments and things when people talk about why they don't find public transport appealing in the ACT. I think it's good to look at something here called revealed versus stated preferences. So people might talk about different reasons why they don't use public transport. But for me, it's really important to actually look at people's behaviour. And sometimes that doesn't actually match up with what they say. To use like a really gold-plated, awesome example, if you've been to a city like London or any city that has a really fantastic, dense metro system, like underground rail system, changing trains is like nothing. You just do it at the drop of a hat. It's super easy to do because there is a high level of frequency and there's dense network coverage across the whole city. So changing isn't such a big deal when you have other things going right in the network. And I really believe that the same thing can happen in Canberra, that changing buses can not be such a big deal if we have buses that are coming on time, so arriving at stops and departing when they say they're going to. So if you've got buses coming on time and frequently enough, changing over becomes less of a big deal. But if you're looking at buses that are coming once every 30 or 60 or on a Sunday every 2 hours, it becomes a really risky prospect to a passenger. Those are some of the types of things that I think need to happen to make particularly using the bus network a bit more attractive for people.
The Greens have been vocal advocates for free fares nationally. We asked Greens leader Larissa Waters what she makes of concerns raised about the free fare policy.
Free public transport is a good idea whose time has come in a fuel crisis. We've seen in Queensland when fares were reduced, usage went up and everyone was happy. This is how we address cost of living pressures in the cities and free up fuel supply for the regions where it is desperately needed. Clearly, the regions need decent public transport in the long run as well, but right now we need to help people save money, and free public transport makes sense. Victoria and Tasmania have already done it. I don't know what the Prime Minister is waiting for. That's exactly what National Cabinet should have announced.
From this week, dental assistants and pathology collectors are receiving a pay rise thanks to the Fair Work Commission. The Commission's landmark gender undervaluation decision was a key factor for the pay rises, particularly when most of the workforce within these jobs are performed by women. The Health Services Union welcomed the decision, explaining the payment will be staged. To explain more about the decision, The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with National Senior Assistant Secretary from the HSU, Kate Marshall.
The Fair Work Commission's been looking at gender undervaluation in female-dominated industries, and it had a look at the Health Professionals and Support Services Award, or the HBSS Award. What that agreement covers is people working within the health professional space, and it is a predominantly a female workforce within that space. So what the Fair Work Commission has decided to do is it's decided to recognise, in the first instance, dental assistants and pathology collectors, saying that they are a predominantly female workforce that has been undervalued and therefore underpaid, and has given them pay rises, which are phased over two stages. Dental assistants will receive a pay increase of 10% phased over two stages. So the first one is taking effect today, and the second one will take effect on January 1st next year. Pathology workers, they're phased, so they'll receive pay increases of between just shy of 2% and up to 10.9%, and they're phased over the two timelines as well. Although the pay increases seem large, like 10% does seem like a lot of money, we've got to remember that they're starting off on a pretty low base wage.
Why was this so important for these workers?
So historically, these workforces have been underpaid. And it is because, on the whole, they are a female-dominated workforce. And I think that the Australian industrial relations system really has an historical issue about systematic undervaluation of predominantly female workforces. So we want to really value the female workforces, and we want to raise them up to where they should be. The rates that they're on, the award rates that they're on currently, need to be higher. They don't actually reflect the work and the time that they do.
I understand there were some other conditions as well put forward into this decision. What were some of the concerns your members tell you about these conditions?
To be clear, this decision is only about wages, but what we've heard about conditions and the list that we're starting to build in how we want to reform the HBSS award, the two big ones would be leave. So compared to some other health professionals, they don't get the same amount of annual leave. The second big one is access to overtime and shift penalties. They don't have ease of access to those conditions. So they are working unsociable hours without the pay benefits that other workforces do receive with regards to overtime and shift allowances.
Now, how will this increase benefit all health workers under the HBSS award?
Health professionals under the HBSS award were also awarded substantial pay increases of up to 32%, which will take effect later this year and will be implemented over five stages as well. So the HBS award, as I said before, is health professionals. They are predominantly female workers who are engaged in this type of work. These pay increases are incredibly important. There are some private companies that made ridiculous profits through the COVID-19 pandemic on the backs of workers who were underpaid and now want to increase their pay. So it is incredibly exciting that this is actually starting to be recognised. But as far as all health professionals under the HBSS award, we've got a long way to go. We really need to continue to push for wages and also conditions.
Kate Marshall from the Health Services Union there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. Returning to Canberra, where a local theatre company focused on cultural change is seeking to bring people from underserved communities together to create art. The mission of Rebus Theatre is amplifying the voices of marginalised communities by co-creating productions to tell their stories. 1RPH's Sarah Guise spoke with Lucien Simon, the artistic director of Rebus Theatre in Canberra, about a recent project with the homeless community in Cairns.
Do you see this sort of theatre as a method for cultural change? Is it about the artists telling the stories, or is it about the stories the communities want to express?
It's a conversation. So, for example, the work that we're creating with the homeless community was developed from interviews with people who experience homelessness and housing insecurity. And those interviews have now become the basis of a script. So there's a verbatim aspect, which is that some of the words are directly part of the script, but there's also a fictionalising of that project, of that process as well. And then we'll go back and bring some of those people who've experienced housing insecurity into the project as actors, working with professional actors. So there's a real conversation. They're invested in the story. They're invested in the need to share that with the community and to share the truth about what it is to be homeless and what it is to have experienced that. And I have experienced that. I'm an artist. I think most artists have experienced housing insecurity and financial crisis. So we have lived experience that we can share. Theirs is far more intense than what I experienced. But what I experienced working with them is that they have a level of beauty that is quite extraordinary, and that comes from suffering and overcoming suffering. There is something about what happens when you overcome suffering that the soul kind of, if we accept that there's something indefinable within us, starts to become more present. And so what we want to do with this show is bring the audience into a space where they stop turning away, not from homeless people as pariahs or ugly people, but turning away so that they can see the beauty. And so that, for us all, becomes a healing experience, not just for the people who have experienced homelessness, but for the society as a whole, so that we can work together to bring about social change, as in housing for all. But that cultural change, which is that seeing people as people who are homeless as worthy citizens of society, is the first thing that needs to happen.
How do you decide whose story to tell and who to collaborate with?
It's a feeling.
This is a very artist answer, isn't it?
So it's a response to place. So that came about because I was in Cairns. I'd moved to Cairns to be the festival director of Cairns Festival, and that was working for the council. It was my first local government job, so I was like, you know, I had a proper paying job and I was working for the government, and you know, so I thought getting a house would be easy, right? But it was almost impossible, and that experience was shared by anyone moving into that area. And then I explored and looked in deeper into it and found there are many reasons why there's a housing shortage in Cairns. And then when you break it down, there's a housing shortage in Australia. And then I was just at the Australian Performing Arts Market talking to festivals overseas about this project, and there's a housing shortage overseas. Something is happening in the world at the moment. We call it the cost of living crisis, but it's deeper than that. And we as a community need to address that, because society's not. Society is making this crisis.
And you can hear that full interview with Lucien Simon by Sarah Guise on the 1RPH website. With that, we've reached the end of today's program. The Wire is a co-production with community radio stations across the country, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri countries where this program has been produced today, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present, and emerging. I'm Noah Seckham. Thanks so much for your company, and tune in again next week for more from the Wire team to bring you the latest in current affairs.